And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, we're in week five of our lockdown. Where is it? Six. It runs together after a while. But today is April 16th. The 106th day of the year in the Gregorian calendar. And it's an interesting date in history. In the year 73 AD, Masada, the Jewish fortress, falls to the Romans after several months of siege. It ends the Great Jewish Revolt. 1346, Stefan Dušan the Mighty is crowned Emperor of the Serbs, his empire occupying much of the Balkans. 1520, the revolt of the Comuneros begins in Spain against the rule of Charles V. 1582, Spanish conquistador Hernando de Lerma founds the settlement of Salta in Argentina. 1746, the Battle of Culloden, fought between the French-supported Jacobites and the British Hanoverian forces commanded by William Augustus, the Duke of Cumberland. It's fought in Scotland. And after the battle, many Highland traditions were banned and the Highlands of Scotland were cleared of inhabitants. 1780, Franz Friedrich Wilhelm von Fürstenberg founds the University of Münster. 1799, the French Revolutionary Wars, the Battle of Mount Tabor. Napoleon drives the Ottoman Turks across the River Jordan near Accra. 1818, the U.S. Senate ratifies the Rush-Bagot Treaty, limiting naval armaments on the Great Lake and Lake Champlain. 1847, shooting of a Maori by an English sailor results in the opening of the Whanganui campaign of the New Zealand Wars. 1853, the Great Indian Peninsula Railway opens the first passenger rail in India, from Borribunder to Thane. 1858, the Lunarian Natural History Society, a former Scottish Learned Society, is wound up. 1862, the American Civil War, Battle of Lee's Mill in Virginia. Also in 1862, the District of Columbia compensated Emancipation Act, the bill ending slavery in the District of Columbia, became law. In 1863, during the Vicksburg Campaign, gunboats commanded by Acting Rear Admiral David Porter runs downriver past Confederate artillery batteries at Vicksburg. 1881, in Dodge City, Kansas, Bet Masterson fights his last gun battle. 1908, Natural Bridges National Monuments established in Utah. 1910, the oldest existing indoor ice hockey arena still used for the sport in the 21st century. Boston Arena opens for the first time. 1912, Harriet Quimby becomes the first woman to fly an airplane across the English Channel. 1917, Vladimir Lenin returns to Petrograd, Russia from exile in Switzerland. 1919, Mohandas Gandhi organizes a day of prayer and fasting in response to the killing of Indian protesters in the Jallianwala Bagh massacre by the British colonial troops 3 days earlier. 1919, the Polish-Soviet War. The Polish army launches the Vilna offensive to capture Vilnius in modern Lithuania. 1922, the Treaty of Rapallo, pursuant to which Germany and the Soviet Union reestablished diplomatic relations, is signed. 1925, during the communist St. Adelaide Church assault in Sofia, Bulgaria, 150 are killed and 500 are wounded. 1941, Italian-German Trigo convoys attacked and destroyed by British ships. 1941, the Nazi-affiliated Ustasi is put in charge of the independent state of Croatia by the Axis powers after Operation 25 is effected. 1943, Albert Hofmann accidentally discovers the hallucinogenic effects of the research drug LSD. He intentionally takes the drug 3 days later on April 19th. 1944, Allied forces start bombing Belgrade, killing about 1,100 people. This bombing fell on the Orthodox Christian Easter. Also in 1945, the Red Army begins the final assault on German forces around Berlin, with nearly 1 million troops fighting the Battle of the Silo Heights. Also in 1945, the United States Army liberates Nazi Sonderlager, a prisoner of war camp Auflager 4C, better known as Kauditz. Also in 1945, more than 7,000 die when a German refugee ship Goya is sunk by a Soviet submarine. 1947, an explosion aboard a freighter in port causes the city of Texas City, Texas, to catch fire, kills almost 600. Also in 1947, Bernard Baruch first applies the term Cold War to describe the relationship between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. 1961, in a nationally broadcast speech, Cuban leader Fidel Castro declares he's a Marxist-Leninist and that Cuba's going to adopt communism. 1963, Martin Luther King Jr. pens his letter from Birmingham jail while incarcerated in Birmingham for protesting against segregation. 1972, the launch of Apollo 16 from Cape Canaveral, Florida. 1990, Dr. Death Jack Kevorkian participates in his first assisted suicide. 2001, India and Bangladesh begin a 5-day border war but are unable to resolve the disputes about their border. 2003, the Treaty of Accession is signed in Athens, admitting 10 new member states to the European Union. 2003, the treaty... 2007, Virginia Tech shooting. Sing-Hwa Cho guns down 32 people and injures 17 more before committing suicide. 2012, the trial for Anders Berg Breivik, the perpetrator of the 2011 Norway attacks, begins in Oslo, Norway. Also in 2012, the Pulitzer Prize winners were announced. It was the first time since 1977 no book won the fiction prize. 2013, a 7.8 magnitude earthquake strikes Sistan in Balochistan province in Iran, killing at least 35 people and injuring 117 more. 2013, the Baga massacre is started when Boko Haram and militants engage government soldiers in Baga. 2014, the South Korean ferry MV Sewol capsizes and sinks near Jindo Island, killing 304 and passengers and crew, and leading to widespread criticism of the South Korean government, media, and shipping authorities. There's a whole lot of folks born on this particular day who became rather prominent. In AD 69, Otho, the Roman emperor, died. 665, Fructuosius of Braga, French archbishop and saint, died. Even saints can die. 1090, Sicogata, Duchess of Apulia, died. 1113, Zvia Topolok II of Kiev, died. 1118, Adelaide de Vesto, regent of Sicily, mother of Roger II of Sicily, Queen of Baldwin I of Jerusalem. 1198, Frederick I, the Duke of Austria, died. 1234, Richard Marshall, 3rd Earl of Pembroke. 1375, John Hastings, the 2nd Earl of Pembroke, died. 1496, Charles II, the Duke of Savoy. 1587, Anne Seymour, Duchess of Somerset. 1640, Countess Charlotte Flandrina of Nassau died. It's amazing just how many rather prominent people were born died on this particular date. Let's look at holidays. Christian Feast Day. Benedict Joseph Labre, Bernadette Soberius, Drogo, Fructosius of Braga, Isabella Gilmore, Church of England, Martyrs of Zaragoza, Molly Brandt, Turibius of Astorga, and it's also the Eastern Orthodox Liturgics Day. Then we have the birthday of Jose de Diego in Puerto Rico, the birthday of Queen Marguerite II in Denmark, Emancipation Day, Washington, D.C., Foursquare Day, international observances, Memorial Day for the victims of the Holocaust in Hungary, National Healthcare Decision Day here in the U.S., Remembrance of Chemical Attack on Balasan and Sikh Wasan, that's Iraqi Kurdistan, and it's World Voice Day. There's always something interesting going on. Okay, we've been talking about conspiracies and secret societies. And one popped up in the news that I found especially interesting. Turns out that the National Institute of Health gave almost $3 million to the Wuhan Virology Lab, the one that the disease is supposed to have originated in and escaped from. Now, in order to make sure that nobody thinks anything ill of China, it was said it wasn't biological warfare. They were showing they could keep up with us in the area of virology, and it just got away from them. It's just a big accident that they tried to cover up for about a week. Well, they're taking advantage of it and trying to dominate the South China Sea as well as Taiwan. If everyone is ill, they can't be defending. Now, ask yourself this. Why aren't the Chinese troops ill? Could it be they have an antidote and they're using it for their people? Certainly that would make sense if, in fact, this is biowarfare. All right, we've been talking about the mafia. And as I said yesterday, the first recorded incident of mafia-based crime occurred in New Orleans in 1891. A Sicilian crime family murdered the local chief of police. He had been after them, arresting, and they said harassing. The family leaders were tried for murder, but thanks to some witnesses being bribed and others being threatened with death, everybody was acquitted. Of course, before they could be released, an angry lynch mob, shouting anti-Italian slogans, stormed the jailhouse, drug them out in the street, and shot or hung 16 of them. Now, this may have been a lesson, because while New Orleans is one of the highest crime rates of any city its size in the country, the influence of the Cosa Nostra there has never reached the level of other communities. I mean, you know, back in the 20s and 30s, La Cosa Nostra ran Chicago, and to a certain extent still does. Now, the introduction of Prohibition in 1919 created a low-cost, high-demand, high-profit opportunity for criminals, especially those in an organization that could manufacture, import, and distribute its product. Well, the northern cities like New York, Chicago, Cleveland, and Detroit are most closely identified with Cosa Nostra activities. But more than two dozen other communities, as bucolic in nature as Des Moines, Iowa, and San Jose, California, have also become operational centers. Now, the repeal of Prohibition in 1933 left an intact organization that just turned its attention to other legal means of making a profit. Again, timing was fortuitous for the criminals and disastrous for the public. 2 years before Prohibition, the state of Nevada legalized gambling, and on the brink of World War II, America developed a taste for narcotics. And both events were quickly and efficiently exploited by Cosa Nostra families. By the 1950s, Cosa Nostra was a dominant factor in almost every criminal activity in the U.S. and the major milker of the Las Vegas cash cow, reaping tens of millions of dollars annually from gambling, prostitution, narcotics, and the old protection racket. Reflecting strategies perfected by the 'Ndrangheta, Cosa Nostra maintained the family structure, though it waived the Calabrian organization's requirement for a blood connection. A fact that easily overlooked any prerequisite for Italian heritage among its partners, welcoming Jewish and Irish criminals on an associate basis. And while every U.S. city center was placed under the aegis of one or more families, the five families in New York and New Jersey became the most celebrated due to their power and to the media that covered their activities. Now, these five families that pretty much are the core are the Bonanno family, founded by Joseph, Joe Bananas Bonanno. The family once was a presence in the garment trade, but became deeply infiltrated by the FBI. And its more recent boss, Joe Massino, has caused the family even more grief than Donnie Brasco did. In fact, you can see a discussion of the Bonanno family in the movie Donnie Brasco. Then there's the Colombo family. The original boss was Joe Profaci, who ran the family from 1930 until his death in 1963 when Joe Colombo assumed the leadership. Colombo was an effective boss right up to the day in 1971 when he was shot at an Italian-American rally. He survived, though he remained in a coma for 7 years before quietly expiring. An extended war developed within the family, with Carmine Persico emerging as the victor until he was sentenced to 139 years in prison for little things like murder and racketeering. His son, Alphonse Alibor Persico, was one of the few Cosa Nostra family bosses to get a college education, where he appears to have majored in wardrobe selection. He likes to dress well, even when tooling around the waters of the Florida Keys in his 50-foot speedboat, christened Looking Good. One day, the Coast Guard, taking a good look at his boat, found a handgun and a shotgun on board. They ordered the guns to be unloaded, inspected the boat, found everything in order, and went on their way. Well, he'd lucked out because nobody on the Coast Guard boat checked his criminal record. And only when the Coast Guard crew returned to port did he learn that Persico had served time for federal racketeering and was banned from owning any firearm, was subject to a 10-year prison term upon conviction. Now, most college graduates would have tossed the guns overboard as soon as the Coast Guard came into sight, but he apparently skipped his classes on logic because a few hours later, when the Coast Guard cutter pulled up alongside the Looking Good at a dock in Key West, the weapons were still on board, and Persico was looking at 10 years in the slammer. Lapses in judgment like that would have made Persico such an ineffective boss that other New York crime families no longer acknowledge the Colombo group. Then we have the Gambino family. This was the infamous John Gotti's family, dating back to the 20s, named for Carlo Gambino, who ran the family from 1956 to 1976. Gambino was considered one of the most effective family heads, or dons as they were called, in Cosa Nostra. Kept a low profile, avoided publicity, stayed in touch with family members, and built the family into a financial powerhouse through narcotics and gambling. In the 70s, he added car theft to the operation, sending stolen luxury automobiles to the Middle East via Kuwait. His successor, his cousin Polly, Big Polly Castellano, alienated various capos, including John Gotti and his underboss, Salvatore Sammy De Bull Gravano, orchestrated Castellano's murder in 1985. Gotti died in prison, where he was serving a life sentence, in 2001, and Gravano, responsible for a reported 20 murders, entered the witness protection program. Through a series of successions, Gotti's son, John Jr., now heads the family. Now, Genovese, another New York family dating back to the 20s. The Genovese gang was originally associated with Charles Lucky Luciano and Frank Costello. More than 50 years before John Gotti smirked and strutted across the newspaper pages and TV news like an escapee from a Saks Fifth Avenue window display, Frank Costello set the mark for class. Always much class as a Cosa Nostra boss can display. Well, Costello possessed political smarts and a talent for strategic planning, and he acquired the title of Prime Minister among gang leaders, a man who preferred smooth talk and bribes over revolvers and shotguns, although he often resorted to those when necessary. For a number of years, mayors, governors, judges, and police officers throughout the Northeast U.S. smiled at the sight or even the mention of Frank Costello because both tended to be accompanied by an envelope of cash. Costello was the original Dapper Don, sporting $1,000 tailored suits, custom-made shoes, perfect manicures, and a bulletproof haircut. Appearances were everything to Frank. Facing charges for tax evasion, he was advised by his lawyer not to appear in court dressed elegantly because it appeared to be alienating the working-class jury. The lawyer said, start wearing cheap suits, old shoes, a lousy tie. You'll do better with the jury. And Frank snorted and said, I'd rather lose the damn case. And he did. While serving his time, Costello tried managing the family from behind bars, but Vito Genovese, the family's ruthless namesake, had other ideas. Genovese wanted to replace Costello at the top. He followed the most widely employed method of succession. Walking down a New York street soon after being released from prison, Costello heard somebody shout, "This is for you, Frank." At the sound of his name, Costello turned his head, and the bullet from the hitman's gun merely grazed his scalp. Well, Frank could take a hint. That's one thing you could say about him. Recovering in the hospital, he spread the word he was retiring from the family business and handed leadership over to Albert Anastasia, who, lacking both Luciano and Costello's good fortune, was gunned down October 1957 while laying back in a barber's chair waiting a shave. Genovese assumed the leadership and gave his name to the family, but he didn't have much time to enjoy the notoriety. Within a few years, he got a 15-year sentence for racketeering and died of cancer in the federal penitentiary. The current boss is Dominic Quiet Dom Cirillo, a man out of the Gambino mold who would have made the family the most powerful and cohesive group in New York. As for Frank Costello, he spent the last few years of his life socializing among New York's elite, hosting parties in his Manhattan apartment, his Long Island estate. His guest list included some of the most famous society and political figures of their time, including, get this, FBI boss J. Edgar Hoover, whose closet homosexuality and preference for cross-dressing Costello, Costello exploited for his own gain. When the Cosa Nostra Prime Minister died in his sleep in 1973, his most prominent legacy perhaps was the raspy voice, borrowed directly from Costello's manner of speaking, adopted by Marlon Brando as Vito Corleone in The Godfather. Then we have the Lucchese family. Gaetano Thomas Lucchese was active in New York's garment industry during his tenure from 1953 to 1967. Among his capos was a man named Paul Verrio, the model for the character Paul Cicero in the movie Godfather. Family's been weak in recent years with the turning of three key members, Alphonse Little Al DiArco, underbossed Anthony, Gaspipe Casso, and Peter Fat Pete Chiodo, into government witnesses. As Cosa Nostra's public profile grew in the minds of the public, an aura of glamour rose around the gangsters, fueled by celebrity associations. Frank Sinatra was often seen in the company of Cosa Nostra bosses throughout his careers, where many of his cronies, including Dean Martin, Al Martino, George Raft, and supposedly Bing Crosby and Jimmy Durante. Sinatra's heritage, his paternal grandparents were Sicilian, lent at least a blood linkage. The singer vehemently denied any association with the crime families, but a famous photograph shows Sinatra standing arm in arm with Carlo Gambino and Paul Castellano and hitman Jimmy Fratiano. And that suggests they were all close friends. When the singer was attracted to the gangsters or the gangsters to the Sicilian-rooted singer remains debatable, but there's no question there was a connection. Much of the glamour and intrigue that outsiders associate with Cosa Nostra flowed from Omerta, the code of honor sealed in a secret induction ceremony that pressed the sanctity of the code upon new members. The secrecy was broken, along with other mystiques of the group, in 1990 when the FBI recorded an induction ritual admitting Robert Bobby D. DeLuca into Boston's Patriarca family. Gathered in a small Bedford, Massachusetts house, the head of the family began by stating loudly in a Sicilian dialect, "In honor of the family is open." FBI lurkers heard DeLuca instructed to repeat an oath spoken by the boss. I, Robert DeLuca, want to enter this organization to protect my family and protect my friends. I swear not to divulge this secret and to obey with love and omerta. Next, each of the eight men pricked their index fingers and dropped their blood onto a holy card bearing an image of the Patriarcha family saint. The card was set on fire, and it was burned. DeLuca repeated the second oath. As burns this saint, so will burn my soul. I enter alive into this organization and leave it dead. With the allure of the secret society, the macho posturing of its leaders, and the immense wealth at the fingertips of its most successful members attracted women to the Cosa Nostra men almost from the beginning. Of course, the reverse was true as well. Many ambitious young Italian men wanted to join because Cosa Nostra members had no trouble attracting good-looking women. Any woman who associates herself with Cosa Nostra quickly learns that the lessons imprinted on Sicilian society by Muslims 1,000 years early remain embedded in the attitudes of Cosa Nostra men. To them, women fulfill one of two available roles, angel or whore, wife or mistress. Wives of Cosa Nostra men enjoy attractive benefits at a price. The benefits include the prospect that her man will rise high enough in the ranks to generate an impressive flow of income, permitting her and her family to enjoy the perks of wealth, a large home, expensive clothes, luxury cars, first-class vacations. Another perk is respect from her husband and his cohorts. The family remains a powerful unifying force among Sicilians, especially among Cosa Nostra members. You don't embarrass your wife. You don't abuse her either. Exceptions exist, of course, but any Cosa Nostra man known to beat his wife or act disdainful of her loses a measure of respect. And if she has her own connections, he could lose more than that. Now, the price paid by the wives is substantial and acknowledged. Male promiscuity within the group is considered a sign of manliness, and the sexuality of any wise guy who is without a mistress or two is certainly suspect. Wives are expected to understand and accept this, just as they understand they're to maintain a level of decorum. Any woman who swears risks being labeled a puttana, a prostitute, and cheating on a husband who happens to be a made man's a capital crime. To avoid embarrassing their wives, Cosa Nostra men set Friday nights aside for their girlfriends. Saturday nights are for wives. And that arrangement is strictly observed, avoiding the possibility of a Cosa Nostra man and his spouse encountering an acquaintance with a woman to whom he's not married. In other situations, the tradition becomes flexible. More than one Cosa Nostra wise guy has taken both his wife and mistress on a luxury cruise, the spouse staying with him in a suite and the mistress closeted in a lower stateroom. And sex and murder collide in a mafia environment with unique consequences. Vito Genovese reportedly had a man killed because Vito wanted the victim's wife for himself. The murder was excused by Genovese's confreres because a man of passion knows that rules and honor can't always control his heart's desire. And while the Cosa Nostra man's excessive heterosexual activity elevates his status, the smallest degree of homosexual interest can be lethal regardless of his standing within the organization. As the fate of Johnny Boy D'Amato proved, he was head of the DiCavalcanti family, the largest in New Jersey and reputed to be the basis of the popular Sopranos television series. He also had been a confidant of the notorious John Gotti, a relationship that might have protected him in other times and circumstances. With his girlfriend Kelly, D'Amato began frequenting clubs where men and women swapped partners and engaged in group sex. At more than one of these events, D'Amato's girlfriend witnessed him performing oral sex on other men, and she tearfully confessed it to one of D'Amato's wise guys. When the friend reported the incident to mafia heavyweight Vincent Vinny Ocean Palermo, the mob boss ordered D'Amato's murder. The motive was clear. As D'Amato's killer testified in court, nobody's going to respect us if we have a gay homosexual boss sitting down discussing business. A millennium of secrecy and ruthless activity may appear to ensure the mafia's survival in Italy, where its future seems assured despite periodic claims by that country's law enforcement groups they've broken the society. In the U.S., though, the future of the Cosa Nostra is not nearly as certain. Unlike Italian mafia, the American Cosa Nostra faces wider competition from rivals, often more ruthless than themselves, including Colombian drug lords, Vietnamese street gangs, and Russian mobsters. Even more critical to Cosa Nostra's survival, respect for the long-standing code of will merit is breaking down just when the society needs it most. This is best demonstrated with a comparison between the actions of two Mafia members that we talked about before, Louis Lepke Burkhalter and Joseph Big Joey Massino. Burkhalter rose through the ranks during the Mafia's glory days of the 20s and 30s as a muscle man in New York's Garment District, where he became notorious for his callous, violent ways. Any manufacturer or shopkeeper who failed to pay his allotted protection money wasn't merely warned or risk having his legs broken. He was simply killed, usually on the side of his business. Burkhalter's standard modus operandi after each killing was to ransack the premises, torch the business, and burn the evidence. Thanks to his notoriety and a few traitorous colleagues, Burkhalter was convicted of murder and sentenced to die in the electric chair March 4, 1944. In spite of appeals by his lawyers for a commutation, Lepke's death sentence was carried out and he was executed along with two associates. Burkhalter was the last of the three to die, and while the first two had stumbled quivering with fear into the execution chamber, Lepke walked in confidently, plopped himself into the electric chair, and sat as impassively as though he were riding the subway to work. 5 minutes after he was strapped in, he was pronounced dead. Next day, Burkhalter's widow hosted a press conference at a hotel near the prison in Ossining in New York, where her husband had been executed. She told reporters, "My husband dictated this statement in his death cell, and I wrote it down word for word." According to Beatrice Burkhalter, Lepke had insisted his statement received the widest possible coverage, and reporters wrote down every word that Beatrice read from his note. He dictated the following: "I'm anxious to have it clearly understood. I did not offer to talk, give information in exchange for any promise or commutation of my death sentence. I did not ask for that." Burkhalter, everybody agreed, was providing a clear signal to Mafia cohorts he had not broken Omerta. Some observers believe he did this to prevent reprisals against his family, but others suggest his motive was less practical and more emotional. Even in death, it was important that others understand he had acted in an honorable fashion toward his colleagues, if not toward his victims. And this was a matter of personal pride, that the prospect of having 5,000 volts of electricity blasting through his body within a few hours could not divert. 60 years later, Big Joey Massino was boss of New York's Bonanno family, the top man of one of Manhattan's five most powerful mafia families. But the 400-pound leader of a group that practiced extortion among the same garment district that Lepke Burkhalter terrorized proved to be a very different kind of man. Omerta may have meant honor to Burkhalter, but it meant nothing to Big Joey, not when he was looking at a hard-time life sentence after being convicted of murder and racketeering. Out on bail in September 2004, the mafia boss did the unthinkable for a man of his stature in the world's most powerful criminal society. He agreed to wear an FBI microphone and record a colleague discussing the slaying of an associate and the planned murder of a federal prosecutor. Through his cooperation, dozens of his family members were brought to justice, and Massino avoided a potential life sentence. When news of Massino's turncoat behavior became known, it hit Cosa Nostra members with the impact of an express train. Now, he was hardly the first to break the Omerta Code. Joe Valachi set that mark back in 63 when he testified to the U.S. Congress about the Mafia's presence, using the term Cosa Nostra in public for the first time. And since then, dozens of members have sought lighter sentences by cooperating with prosecutors. In every previous case, though, there were lower-level wise guys with limited knowledge of the family's operation, no hope of reaching the higher levels where the big money was earned, and maybe with a grudge or two against the men above them. The turning of a family boss was unprecedented and foreshadowed the possibility of a real breakdown of discipline within the organization. How can any Cosa Nostra family generate respect and loyalty and exert discipline among the low levels when a family head betrays the entire organization? Based on this, the future of secrecy within the American branch of the Mafia Cosa Nostra is in doubt. The prospect of its continued existence, the strength of its control over criminal activities long associated with it, are even less certain. And from the Italian criminal activities, we talk about the Japanese, the Yakuza. You know, Tokyo's Ginza District remains the same glitzy entertainment area it's been since the end of World War II, a Japanese blend of New York's Broadway and London's Soho with a dash of Las Vegas. One recent night on a main Ginza thoroughfare, several dozen Japanese businessmen sat mesmerized in front of pinball machines, watching small, shiny balls meander their way through a maze of metal pins. This is pachinko, a national craze among Japanese men. Its name derived from the sound of the chrome balls as they bounce against the pins over and over and over again. The atmosphere as in a private men's club located directly above the parlor is very different. Here the lights are dim, the furniture is plush, there's soft music played on traditional Japanese instruments. They float through the smoky air, filling every corner. In a far corner, a man in his 60s sat in front of a low table, flanked by two women who giggled at the orders he gave in a harsh, guttural manner to several young men hovering nearby. The men approached at his command, nodded at his instructions, bowed and withdrew, sent on errands elsewhere in the club or on to the busy street below. A simple nod from the older man brought a drink or a serving of tempura from an attractive waitress. A similar gesture silenced one of the younger men in mid-sentence. From time to time, the older man smiled at the younger women, one in a short cocktail dress, the other in a schoolgirl's pleated plaid skirt and starched white blouse. When he slipped his hand up the leg of the woman in the cocktail dress and stroked the blouse of the woman in the schoolgirl uniform, they laughed nervously and covered their mouths. Well, to a Westerner, the scene appeared to be a Japanese version of a mafia godfather dispensing orders, retribution, and rewards to his underlings. And in some ways, that's exactly what it was. In other ways, it differed, especially when a young man appeared at the entrance to the club and stood waiting for his presence to be announced. Dressed in the same slim-fitting suits as the other man his age, his hair shining, his white shirt perfectly starched, he lingered nervously, shifting his weight from one foot to the other. His face pale. His left hand was bandaged. His right hand held a small, carefully wrapped object. Finally, responding to a nod from the older man and keeping his head down, his eyes lowered, the younger man approached the older man in the corner. At this, the girls ceased their giggles. The other young men stepped aside, permitting him to pass. The room became silent. Standing in front of the older man, the newcomer, his eyes and head still lowered, set the small parcel, using both hands in a gesture of solemn ceremony, onto the table. The older man looked at the young man's bandaged hand, nodded, and waved his own hand over the package as a signal to remove it. One of the other young men came and whisked it away. Well, inside that package was the severed last joint of the newly arrived man's pinky finger, removed and submitted as an act of contrition and a plea for forgiveness. Something the younger man had done offended the older man, who was his boss. Apparently, other men in the room had offended him in a similar fashion. Many of them were also lacking a portion of their smallest finger. Some had no small finger on that one hand at all, suggesting multiple affronts committed in the past. This was the Japanese Yakuza, the secret crime society tracing its origins back to the days of samurai warriors and enforcing discipline in the same traditional and terrible manner. Like chivalrous knights defending a lady's honor and flint-eyed sheriffs of the American Wild West, samurai warriors were viewed by many as guards of medieval Japan's moral standards. Of course, once again, the reality falls far short of the legend. The samurai rose out of coalitions of warrior chiefs in 12th century Japan, which was evolving into a feudal society, much like the one already established in Europe. As with European feudalism, weaker leaders and groups pledged allegiance to larger, more powerful forces in return for protection. These groups, bonded by personal family loyalty, began selecting its best fighters among them to serve as gentlemen warriors, men skilled in combat, prepared at any moment to defend their personal chiefs. In fact, the word samurai is translated as one who serves. Along with their fighting ability, the samurai were marked by a fanatical dedication to loyalty. And over time, this loyalty aspect grew to override other aspects of the warrior's life. Love of wife and children, duty to one's parents, fear of death were all secondary to the samurai's obligation of absolute loyalty and ferocity when encountering an adversary. Battles between warring factions became chilling events marked by samurai fighters boasting of their prowess and the exploits of their illustrious ancestors as they swung their swords at the bodies of their enemies. You know, such ferocity and dedication set the samurai apart from the rest of Japanese society and earned them some special privileges. Only recognized samurai, for example, permitted to own the katana, the long two-handed swords the samurai revered like sacred objects. If a samurai believed he'd been insulted by somebody of a lower birth status, he could cut the offender in two with his sword and suffer absolutely no punishment for it. Samurai weapons evolved into the central object of an elaborate code of honor. Swords used to slay many opponents in battle believed to possess spiritual powers, and new swords were tested on human bodies, usually the corpses of beheaded criminals. Like medieval knights, wealthy samurai fought on horseback, clad in helmet and flexible armor, while less affluent warriors functioned as foot soldiers. Unlike their European counterparts, though, samurai were motivated not by religious fervor or motives of chivalry, but by simple dedication to the orders of their warlords. In this sense, they resembled mafia capos more than heroic battlers. And contrary to the aura often associated with the samurai, there wasn't much heroism exhibited during battle. There's one account of a 13th century raid on an emperor's palace. And it said the nobles, the courtiers, and even the ladies-in-waiting of the women's quarters were slashed to death. The palace was set ablaze when the occupants rushed out so as not to be burned by the fire. They were met by warriors. When they were forced to go back, they were consumed by the flames. Some even jumped into wells in large numbers, and of these, the bottom ones in a short time had drowned. Those in the middle were crushed to death by their fellows, and those on top were cut to pieces or burned by the flames. Inevitably, Admiral Samurai standards grew corrupted with time, and eventually even their noble causes began to crumble. In the 17th century, the Hatamoto Yako, servants of the shogun, were an extravagant branch of independent samurai, found their services unneeded during an extended period of peace. And unable to function in ordinary society, they veered from performing service on behalf of their warlords to creating mayhem among the populace. In some cases, they acted like Robin Hood, inspired folk heroes, defending the poor and the defenseless and sharing stolen booty with starving peasants. However, in most instances, they grew as ruthless and exploitive as any mob of hoodlums, despite their claimed penchant for ceremony and honor. This evolution of samurai from hero warriors to organized thugs generated a response to the victims of their plundering, common folk who shrugged off their veneration of samurai and responded by forming a citizen's militia known as the Machiyoko. Within a few years, the tables have been turned against the samurai. The Machiyoko are now viewed as protectors of the ordinary Japanese, and they acquired a mantle of respect and reverence while operating beyond the reach of the law, a direct parallel with the rise of Sicilian mafia. When the samurai were subdued, the Machiyoko remained as defenders of the common folk, even after modern-day Japanese culture arrived with centralized authority and law enforcement, which left the Machiyoko outside the law. By this time, the various Machiyoko branches began referring to themselves as Yakuza, a name derived from the organization's fondness for gambling. One of their favorite games, Hanafuda, flower cards, was played with three cards in which the worst possible hand totaled 20 points. Ya in spoken Japanese means eight, and S-A means three, yielding the dreaded 20-point hand. And implying that Yakuza members are the bad hands of society. As the Freemasons did with the Templar legend, the Yakuza fostered an association with the more noble aspects of the samurai, and their practice of severing a pinky finger as punishment relates directly back to the ancient warrior class. When wielding a katana, the swordsman's pinky finger exerted greater control over the weapon than any other part of his hand. A samurai with an injured or missing pinky was a distinct disadvantage in battle and relied heavily on his master for protection. Thus, the punishment exerted by Yakuza bosses on errant members. Removal of a pinky, known as yubazim, represents punishment for displeasing or disappointing a Yakuza master and symbolizes both the member's error and the courage. The offended Yakuza is alerted to the need for the amputation when his superior hands him two items, a knife and a link of string to staunch the bleeding. No words are spoken. In fact, none is necessary. The offender must have no connection with the group until he carries out his own punishment, confirms its completion, and receives forgiveness from the master. In addition to incomplete pinkies, Yakuza members may be identified by their extensive tattoos, often applied not as individual symbols like those favored in the West, but as extensive murals depicting dragons and flowers and landscapes and abstract designs applied to parts of their body normally covered in with everyday clothing. With his face, neck, lower arms, ankles, and feet left free of tattoos, a naked Yakuza appears to be wearing long underwear. The meticulous application of the designs takes hundreds of hours and costs thousands of dollars, but it remains hidden from view to all but his most intimate partners. Its purpose is to demonstrate to those who witness the body art that its owner has both the wealth and the courage to absorb the cost and the pain. Westerners who encounter a group of Yakuza without knowing their identity may see them as unintentionally comic. The members favor tight-fitting silk suits, pointed-toe shoes, slick long hair in a pompadour style, and a swagger more reminiscent of the sitcom TV character The Fonz than butchers like Vito Genovese and Louis Lepke Burkhalter. The gangster clique is strengthened by the preference among Yakuza members for American Cadillac and Lincoln automobiles, oversized and ostentatious in the land of Toyotas and Hondas. Reflecting the classic pyramid structure of the Mafia Cosa Nostra, the Yakuza organization is somewhat more complex and multi-layered based on the Oyabun-Koban relationship. Oyabun means father role and Koban means child role. Unquestioned loyalty to the boss is demanded of every Yakuza member. A Yakuza doctrine dictates when your boss says the passing crow is white, you have to agree it's white. An underling's filling the child role must never differ from the father's opinion. The Oyabun, in turn, is obligated to offer protection and wise counsel to all of his children. At the summit of each Yakuza organization is the Kamicho, or supreme boss. Immediately underneath him are the Seiko Koman, his senior advisor, and the Sohunbucho, or headquarters chief. The Yakagashira are regional bosses who manage several gangs, each assisted by Fuku Hanbucho, who may have several gangs of his own. Lesser regional bosses are Shatagashira, with a Shatagashira Hosa assisting them. Within each gang family are several Shatai, or younger brothers, and Wakashu, junior leaders. Initiation into a Yakuza gang is filled with symbolism, but surprisingly passive in nature. The candidate and his Oyabun sit facing each other while cups of sake are prepared for the ceremony by adding salt and fish scales to the heated liquor, which is poured into each man's cup. The cups are identical in size, but the Oyabun's cup is always filled to the brim, while the candidate receives much less. When the Oyabun raises his cup to drink from it, the candidate does the same. When the two men exchange cups, drinking from each other's, this sharing of the drink seals the entry of the young man into the group. Yakuza existed in Japan for 300 years without making a major impact on society, although its members were major participants in the widespread corruption that marked Japanese society in the 20s and 30s. In the years following World War II, greater freedom and prosperity saw Yakuza membership grow spectacularly. One recent estimate suggesting that 5,200 Yakuza gangs are operating throughout the country, which put the total number of Yakuza members at about 184,000, making them larger in numbers than a Japanese army at the time. Japanese police pressure in recent years has shrunk Yakuza, but they remain a potent force in Japan and through intermediaries and political connections in Korea, China, and the Philippines as well. They tend to favor sex-related activities, running prostitution rings often consisted of younger girls purchased from poor Chinese and Philippine families. Other young women may be attracted to Japan with promises of high-paying jobs as waitresses, receptionists, and models. Once in Japan, they're put to work first as strippers and later as prostitutes. In recent years, the Yakuza have branched into smuggling banned automatic weapons and drugs into the country. Although traditional narcotics like heroin and cocaine are less popular these days than methamphetamine, they're also reputed to be deeply involved in casino operations throughout the world, preying on Chinese gamblers who are offered large cash loans in Las Vegas, Atlantic City, Monte Carlo, and elsewhere. The wealthy gamblers, assuming the loans will be uncollectible back in Japan, are enticed to borrow substantially. If they lose, and frankly most do, they return to Japan to discover Yakuza partners of the loan sharks are determined to collect the debt along with a murderous rate of interest. Maybe the group's most lucrative and profitable diversification has been in the corporate field, where its leaders have grown adept at a uniquely Japanese form of extortion. After acquiring a few shares in a large publicly traded company, the accuser gathered scandalous information about the firm's top executives. Some of the executives' activities, such as dalliances with prostitutes or drug habits, the Yakuza themselves may have fostered. Evidence of other practices, such as tax evasion, maintaining unsavory factory conditions, and ignoring environmental laws, are obtained through bribery. When enough dirt's been accumulated, the Yakuza members approach the top members of the corporate's executive committee shortly before the annual board meeting and deliver an ultimatum. Either the Yakuza are well compensated for destroying the evidence, or the group's meeting men will disclose the information at the annual shareholders meeting. The Sokoyaya, or the meeting men, are chosen for their vehement style, capable of shouting down anybody who tries to silence them and describing the executive's behavior in colorful, provocative language. Japanese society is sensitive to revelations causing shame and embarrassment, and corporate CEOs and others quickly pay whatever the Yakuza demand. According to Japanese sources, the Yakuza made millions of dollars from this technique. Still, the glory days of the Yakuza may be fading. Many Japanese citizens refuse to be cowed by the gangsters and have driven the organization from some neighborhoods in spite of threats, beatings, and killings. The organization may also be breaking up from the inside because, unlike the Mafia Cosa Nostra, Yakuza members do not dedicate their lives to the group. Many Yakuza thugs, having joined while impressionable young men, chose to leave in their mid-30s, having salted away their earnings or being attracted to a less strenuous corporate life. In some instances, these Yakuza dropouts have discovered the managerial skills acquired in their years as Yakuza members are highly varied in the corporate world. And many apparently occupy executive suites in corporations they may have targeted at one time for attack by the Sokaya. How they managed to explain a missing peak or their elaborate body tattoo art remains a mystery, but apparently they've been able to do it. Now, this next secret society is not criminal, per se. It's Wicca. Now, among the world's many secret societies, most choose their covert nature as a means of avoiding harassment from groups and individuals who felt threatened by the society's existence. And perhaps no faction in history is more severely persecuted in Europe and elsewhere than witches. From the early medieval period through the Renaissance, untold thousands died, often under horrific circumstances, on the basis of nothing more than mere suspicion or empty accusations. With few exceptions, the victims were women, and in many instances their persecutors are male members of the Christian Church. And while we think of the medieval and Reformation periods in Europe as the era of persecution against witches, the practice of witchcraft predates Christianity. Originally, the term applied to anybody who practiced magic. Both the pre-Christian Greeks and Romans made a distinction between white and black witchcraft. White magic was positive, including the ability to bring good fortune or cure illnesses, while black witchcraft was any mystical action that caused harm against others. The Romans declared any witch or magician who caused the death of another through spells or potions was subject to the same capital punishment as somebody who committed murder with a sword or poison, which, frankly, was a reasonable rule at the time. In reality, witchcraft is usually little more than an extension of pagan religions that believed their gods were embodiments of natural power similar to the Druids. Some of these belief cultures assign powers not to plant life, such as the oak and mistletoe revered by Druids, but to animals, goats, cattle, and especially in Europe, cats. A good deal of witchcraft in this period was as harmless as any personal spiritual practice. A few practitioners, though, recognized the power that accrued to anybody who could make a plausible claim to casting spells and mixing potions, activities that, of course, generated fear and income among credible neighbors. In this environment, witchcraft was viewed as simply another trade, like the practice of medicine, like it with an equal measure of success and failure. The advent of Christianity changed everything, though. Clear distinctions are made between mystical practices and praises of the Christian God and similar activities not sanctioned by the church. In an ecclesiastical version of the "you're either with us or against us" doctrine, unsanctioned mystical activities were associated with Satan and condemned accordingly. Frankly, it's been my experience with the Christian church. Anything you do they don't agree with is evil. even when I was growing up. Those who sat on the what was called the Amen pew, and they were people who believed they sat at God's right hand, could claim that what anybody else did was evil, needed to be punished. And I've watched businesses put out of business because the owners crossed people who sat in the Amen pew. Well, women are perceived as tools of the devil. And of all the sins condemned by Christianity, the ones most often linked with satanic practices involve sex. And since power within the church resided exclusively with men, who frequently found themselves tempted by the sight or the passive activities of women, females became the target of persecution against witches. I mean, after all, what better method did Satan have for tempting a God-fearing man toward sin than through the wiles of a nuble female? So, as I said, women were perceived as tools of the devil in his crusade to garner the souls of Christian men, and as much as any other factor, this contributed to hundreds of years of persecution. The hanging, drowning, burning, imprisonment, mutilation of untold thousands of women over the past two millennia had nothing to do with subversive ideology, religious deviation, or racial discrimination. Had everything to do with gender and with the centuries-old dominance of men over women, a dominance that extends beyond sexuality and economic influence to include spiritual authority. In other words, God told me to do it. And while we may be more tolerant and even amused by claims of witchcraft and its practitioners today, Christian fundamentalists need look no further than the Bible for justification to abuse anybody suspecting of being a witch. For rebellion is the sin of witchcraft, they'll read in 1 Samuel chapter 15, verse 23, proof that the major failing of witches is a refusal to follow orders. In search of more direct instructions, Christians might examine Exodus chapter 22, verse 18, "Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live." Modern theologians may argue about the true interpretation of these admonitions, but as recently as the 19th century, European and American civilizations accepted them as explicit authority to burn, hang, and drown women on the basis of their witch-like behavior. Leading oppressors of uncounted thousands of women who suffered this fate through the centuries were always men, and the root of their charges against the victim was still associated with one sin above all, sex. The most devastating charge that could be brought against witches in Christian mythology was they engaged in sexual acts with the devil. Perhaps as a means of rewarding those who gave into this lust, Satan was believed to grant his partners occult power, such as controlling the minds of others, casting evil spells, and having the ability to move solid items with a mere thought or gesture. Throughout history, the Roman Catholic Church assumed a leading role in demonizing witches, especially in 1450 when it recycled many of its old charges against pagans, making no distinction between those who chose to identify themselves as witches performing magical acts and earth-based religions that were usually forms of Druidism. The Church's only goal was to convert the pagans to Catholicism. And as was often the case, its motives and methods were both heavy-handed and reckless with facts. Claiming that pagans worshiped the devil, for example, conveniently ignored the fact that the devil's a Judeo-Christian creation. So how could pagans worship a being whose existence was unknown to them? Well, such realities fail to deter church officials. We're going to talk more about this tomorrow night, but right now we've come to the end of the show. So until tomorrow night at 6 p.m., 8 o'clock Mountain Eastern, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.